Until we begin Chumash Devarim, we should note that if we read carefully the opening psukim of Devarim, the Sefer seems to take a while to get going, to begin. And by that we mean there are actually five psukim of introduction before Moshe says anything. Moshe is referred to as talking to the Bnei Yisrael no less than three times before he's actually said anything. Pasuk Aleph begins, El Hadvar Mashir Dibre Moshe, which one could argue should be the beginning of the Sefer. But in Pasuk Gimel, again, Vayhi Bar Bem Shana, Bashter Sachodesh Bechad Chodesh, Dibre Moshe, Bnei Yisrael, Moshe speaks to Bnei Yisrael. Once again, he's introduced as speaking to Bnei Yisrael. And then again in Pasuk Hey, Be'eva Hayard in Be'eretz Moav, Ho'il Moshe Be'er Es HaTorah Hazos Le'mor. Moshe began to explain the Torah. So the question is, why is there so much introduction before Moshe actually speaks? And this question is addressed by the Vilna Gaon in the Sefer Aderes Eliyahu. And he draws our attention, I mean, it's in front of us the whole time, but until it's formulated for us, that Chumash Devarim can actually be divided into three distinct sections. You have the opening chapters, which, as we see clearly, are words of Musar v'Tochacha, they're words of exhortation, of rebuke, of retrospection. Those are the opening chapters of the Sefer. Then Devarim moves on to discuss mitzvahs, which it does as well for quite a number of prokim, not only to reiterate mitzvahs that Bnei Yisrael know already, but also mitzvahs that they haven't heard. The parsha of Kiseitse contains within it, if I understand correctly, more mitzvahs per parsha than any other parsha. So mitzvahs is certainly a significant section of Chumash Devarim. And then, after the mitzvahs have been discussed, the balance of Chumash Devarim is, in a sense, Moshe parting from Bnei Yisrael, getting them ready for entry into Eretz Yisrael. You have the Tochacha again, then you have the Brachot, but those have Brachot, Asher Diber Moshe. And these, therefore, represent the three domains of Chumash Devarim: Divrei Tochacha, Mitzvos, and Divrei Bris, really, the covenant of the Bnei Yisrael, how they should proceed from here in the future. And the Vilna Gaon explains that corresponding to these three sections in Chumash Devarim, the Chumash opens with three introductions. In other words, and this is a fascinating way of looking at it, because from the very outset, there are three introductions because there are three areas that are being introduced. Pasuk Aleph, Eila Hadvar Masher Dibre Moshe, these are the words of Moshe. And Pasuk Aleph itself already contains some form of tochacha, of rebuke. Pasuk Aleph is the introduction to the first section of Devarim, which is that of tochacha. The second introduction in Pasuk Gimel, Vayhi bar ba'im shana, ba'ashtei asar chodesh b'echad chodesh, diber Moshe al b'nei Yisrael k'chol asher tziva Hashem oso aleihem. So that's a very interesting way of looking at these words, that Moshe spoke to B'nai Yisrael in accordance with everything that Hashem commanded him. We would have understood that Hashem commanded him to say the beginning of Chumash Devarim, but says the Gaon, k'chol asher tziva Hashem oso aleihem, refers to mitzvahs. Tziva is mitzvahs. That's the introduction of the section where Moshe is presenting mitzvahs to them. And then, and this in a sense is the biggest chiddush for me, when it says, Be'eva Hayardin Be'eretz Moav in Pasuk Hey, the third introduction, Ho'il Moshe Be'eres HaTorah Hazos. Moshe begins to explain the Torah. I think this is a chiddush of the Gaon, that we would have understood that the biur of the Torah is an elucidation of the mitzvahs, of its details, of its finer points. But according to the Vilna Gaon, this third introduction is actually introducing the third section of Chumash Devarim, which are the Divrei Habris, and therefore, in his understanding, the Biur, the explanation is not so much the elucidation of the details of the mitzvahs, but it's actually a biur as to what Torah is all about, what being the Jewish people is all about. And that's the brachas and the klolos and their brachas as they enter into Eretz Yisrael. And it's about the future of the Jewish people. It's about Jewish destiny. That's the biur of the Torah. What's it all about? And with this, says the Vilna Gaon, we can understand the words of the Medrash, which otherwise would seem rather elusive. For the Medrash states, Vayikra, hu malei halachos. Chumash Vayikra is full of halachos, which it is, more or less, from beginning to end. Says the Medrash, ukenegdo devarim malei halachos. And corresponding to Vayikra being full of halachos, devarim is also full of halachos. Says the Vilna Gaon, I understand the Vayikra is full of halachos. It is. From the very beginning, from Perek Aleph Pasuk Beis, it is already halachos. Almost till the end. Chumash Devarim has halachos in it, but it's not full of halachos. I mean, it's got so many other things in it. So how can we say that it corresponds to Vayikra in the fact that it's full of halachos? It can't be full if it contains other things. Says the Gaon, we have mentioned as a matter of generality that Chumash Devarim is divided into three. But let us now find exactly where are those dividing points, if we can. And we can, because we're guided by the Vilna Gaon. The first section, of course, begins at the beginning. It's Parshas Devarim. And in fact, it goes until the beginning of Perek Hay. Because the beginning of Perek Hay is where Moshe brings the Jewish people back to Aseres HaDibros, and Aseres HaDibros is when they first receive mitzvahs, and from that point onwards, it's the introduction of the section of mitzvahs. So the point of transition from Tochacha to mitzvahs is the beginning of Perek Hay. Till when do the mitzvahs continue? They continue until the beginning of Perek Kaf Zayin, that's Shoftim, Re'ei, Shoftim, Kiseitse, full of mitzvahs. And the beginning of Kaf Zayin, we have the beginning of Moshe addressing Bnei Yisrael as they're about to enter into Eretz Canaan, Har Grizim, Har Eval, Brachos, and the Klalos were already moving into Divrei HaBris. What's very interesting is the transitional point from Tochacha to Mitzvos, which, as we mentioned, is the beginning of Perek Hay. So that Perek begins with the words, Perek Hay Pasuk Aleph. Vayikra Moshe al Kol Yisrael, Vayomer Aleihem, Shema Yisrael es Achukim v'Mishpatim. So he tells them to remember the Mishpatim, and from there it goes into Matan Torah. As Moshe moves into the third section of Devarim, which is in Perek Kaf Zayin Pasuk Tes, it says, "Vayidaber Moshe al Bnei Yisrael Lemor Haskesu Shema Yisrael Hayom Hazeh Niyesa La'am," and so on and so forth. What's fascinating is, it turns out that the three sections of Chumash Devarim actually open with the same words as the three Chumashim of Shemos, Vayikra, and Bamidbar. Shemos begins with the words Ve'eile Shemos Bnei Yisrael, and so does Devarim begin with Eile HaDevarim. Vayikra begins with Vayikra, and the mitzvah part of Devarim begins with Vayikra, Perek Hay Pasuk Aleph, Vayikra Moshe El Kol Yisrael. Bamidbar begins with the word Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Bamidbar Sinai, and the third section of Chumash Devarim begins with the word Vayidaber Moshe Al Kol Yisrael. And therefore, says the Gaon, we now see not only is Chumash Devarim divided into three, but there exists a correspondence between the three sections and the three Chumashim. And thus, when the Medrash says that Vayikra is full of halachos, ukenegdo sefer devarim malei halachos, and corresponding to Vayikra, sefer devarim is full of halachos, it does not refer to the entirety of devarim, because devarim has many other things. It refers to the aspect or the element of devarim which corresponds to Vayikra, because the part of devarim that begins with Vayikra until Vayidaber is Male Halachas. It is the section of Halachas. So this is an eye-opening analysis of the Vilna Gaon, for we no longer look at the beginning of Chumash Devarim and say it has lots of introduction, but rather we see that it has lots of introductions. And it's essentially introducing in slow release all of the three sections of Chumash Devarim. Now let's take a look at the beginning. The first section, which as we've mentioned is Divrei Tochacha, and Rashi famously, and he takes his cue from Unculus, because although Unculus is Targum Unculus, but once in a while, Unculus does not merely translate. Unculus gives an insight. He gives a commentary. Ultimately, every translation is a commentary, but when he really is commenting, so then it's unavoidable. Because the first pasuk of the Chumash is a list of places. And what is the meaning of this? Especially as they're already in Arvos Moav, so they can't be in all of the other places. They're not Mulsuf. They're not Bein Paran or Bein Tofel, wherever those places are. They're only in one place. And that's where Rashi adopts the approach of Unculus, that as Moshe is talking to them in Arvos Moav, but he's talking to them about all of those other places. And what does he mean to say? Well, this is a list of places where the Jewish people made mistakes, and that's really what the opening section of Chumash Devarim is about. It's about talking about those mistakes and learning from them. However, because it is the opening of the Sefer, says Rashi, Mishum Kvodam Shel Yisrael, as a gesture of respect to the Jewish people, Moshe does not open with all guns blazing, but rather he opens in a very moderate and benign way. He mentions the names of the place. V'hameivin Yovin. Of course, there's a territorial hazard of giving tochacha in that way. It tends to be that the people who most need to hear it are most prone to avoid it. But nonetheless, that's the price that Moshe is beginning to pay. Within the fullness of time, he will talk about all of these events explicitly and graphically. But the first thing that needs to be established is Kavodam Shel Yisrael. If he gives them rebuke and they don't see that he respects them, so then the rebuke is a waste of time. It's a malacha shena tzricha legufa. And therefore, Moshe, the first point is, let's talk about these places. Anyone who didn't get it, we'll talk further tomorrow. And I'd like to focus on the final place mentioned in Pasuk Aleph, which is called V'dizahav. Now, what's interesting is, not only does Moshe not talk explicitly, but many of these places, we've never heard of them before, which is interesting because you can't have a retrospective discussion about something that you never saw in real time. Half of these places, Tofel, we haven't met yet, and Dizahav, we haven't met yet. Rather, some of them are characterizations of certain Averis, and Dizahav, of course, as soon as you hear the word gold, we know what it's a reference to, the Egel Hazav. Rashi comments, Hochichon al ha'egel, she'asu bishvil rov zahav shehayalahem. Moshe rebukes them regarding the egel, which they made because they had so much gold. Now, what's interesting is, we should know, the source of Rashi's words is a Gemara in Maseches Brachos and Daf Lamed Beis Amud Aleph, commenting on these words v'dizahav. But what's fascinating is the context in which the Gemara explains these words v'dizahav is Moshe defending Bnei Yisrael. It's actually unbelievable what Moshe will say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in defense of the Bnei Yisrael. Because he says, Bishvil kesef v'zahav shehirbei salahem. You gave them so much gold and silver. V'dizahav ad she'amru dai. In other words, they couldn't hold anymore. They said enough. And for people to say enough to gold and silver means it's a lot. And therefore, it's a mistake we never repeated, I don't think. That's why they made the egel. And what's very clear, Moshe is, this is not vidui. This is defense. Moshe is defending the Jewish people. But if he's defending the Jewish people, then who's to blame? Well, what's he saying? You gave them so much gold and silver, so what do you expect? I mean, that's really what he's saying. That's quite a defense. But it's from these words, v'dizahav. And the reason why it's so interesting is because the very same words were said in context to the Jewish people as part of a rebuke. And that means, if you'll pardon the expression, there's two sides to this coin. Because, on the one hand, when talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Moshe says, you gave him so much gold, they couldn't help it. What do you expect of them? They had too much gold, they didn't know what to do. Too much money, not enough to spend it on. And to Bnei Yisrael, it's the opposite. In other words, it's part of the rebuke. Hashem gave you all this gold, and that's what you did? That's how you repay him? He gives you he financed your egel? It's his gold with which you made the egel. So it's fascinating because depending on whose perspective, it either makes it worse or makes it better, and each side needs to hear something different. So these are the words v'dizahav. What's interesting is, if we've seen the Rashi, which we have, and we've referenced the Gemara, which we have, we will note that Rashi did not quote the entire commentary of the Gemara on these words. Because once again, there's two words, vidi, zahav. Zahav is gold. Rashi's spoken about that. But the word vidi is explained by the Gemara as an expression of dai. Vidi, zahav, zahav, until they said dai. Rashi does not say until they said dai. Rashi says, and on the one hand, it's not appropriate for the rebuke, because whether they said enough or not is perhaps not relevant. But Rashi has taken half of the explanation, half of the interpretation, and left the other half. Why would he do that? Well, perhaps on a very simple level, Rashi didn't need the element of Acher Amrudai. As if to say, the point for the Jewish people is Hashem gave you the gold and you made the egel with it. Whether or not you said die is neither here nor there. And therefore Rashi, for his purposes, he doesn't need the element of Acher Amrudai, and therefore he doesn't mention it. But I think perhaps there may be another reason why Rashi doesn't mention the part of Acher Amrudai. It could be that it is Rashi Lishitoso, Rashi consistent with his approach to this matter as we see elsewhere. We have seen that it was the profusion of gold and silver. It was the fact that they had so much. That's what caused them to, or was a catalyst for the Egel. That's really part of the discussion here. Ribui kesef v'zahav. Well, when did the Jewish people receive so much gold and silver? Our intuition says, well, as we know, when they left, v'yishalu me'esh ve'ehu, klei kesef, u'klei zahav. So they left with gold and silver. I mean, that's what we're talking about. But what's interesting is that was not the final installment of Rechush Gadol. That was actually an advance, if anything. Because we find a week later, when the Egyptians have drowned in the Yamsuf, the Pasuk states in Shmos, Perek Tesvav, Pasuk Kaf Beis, Vayasa Moshe es ha'am miyamsuf. Vayasa, that's an unusual word. Normally it's vayisu, vayisu vayachanu, which what we're used to from Parshas Maaseh. They traveled. Here the Pasuk doesn't say they traveled. The Pasuk says Moshe traveled them. Vayasa is a causative. I mean, he moved them away from the Yamsuf. Why does he need to move them at the Yamsuf? What are they there for? Why don't they want to move? The answer, says Rashi, quoting Medrash Rabbah Shir Hashirim, is that when Paro wanted to entice his army to chase after the Jewish people, who were not so keen by that point. I think there was a lot of Baruch Shepatrani going around. When the Jewish people finally left Mitzrayim, the last thing you want to do is run after them. But Paro wanted to run after them. So how does he entice his army? Well, money talks. So he bedecked all of the war horses and the chariots with gold and silver, and he says, this is to be divided between anyone who comes with me. Even though the Pasuk says that the Jewish people cleaned out Egypt, Vayinatzlo es Mitzrayim, but the Mefarshim explain that was on a local level. Paro has resources which are way in excess of anything that his country has all put together. And he put all of that onto the horses and delivered it to the Jewish people, essentially, because they rode after them, drowned in the Yamsuf, and the Yamsuf was washing up. I mean, one never knew what would turn up next. And therefore, the Jewish people were not so keen to travel. Because the longer they stay, the more they'll find. They seem to be acclimatizing to their new location quite nicely. That's why, at a certain point, Moshe has to move them on. And, says Rashi, again quoting from the Medrash, U'gedola haysa bizas hayam, mibizas Mitzrayim. There was more wealth washed up by the Yam Suf. As we mentioned, Paro single-handedly was more wealthy than anyone else, his entire country put together. So they received more of the Yam Suf than they did from everything they got in Mitzrayim. Now, if that's true, then if we come again to discuss what was the money that, or the gold that caused the Jewish people to make the Egel, Ribuy Zahav, where was the Ribuy Zahav? There was more Ribuy Zahav at the banks of the Yam Suf than there was in Mitzrayim. And if that's true, but Rashi has adopted that approach. And moreover, the Medrash adduces the Pasuk from Shir HaShirim, Torei Zahav Naaselach in Nekudos HaKosef. Lines of gold we shall make for you with dots of silver. Says the Medrash, what they took out from Mitzrayim was the equivalent of dots and silver. Not bad for a start, but it's dots of silver. What they got from the banks of the Yam Suf was Torei Zahav, lines of gold. So there's an emphasis on gold at the Yam Suf that they're in contrast to what they took from Mitzrayim. That being the case, I think it's not so simple for Rashi to quote the entire drush of the Gemara. Because if you say that it was the gold that they received until they said die, well, as far as Rashi is concerned, the most gold that they got, they weren't saying die. They were actually saying, well, let's see what else comes. There was no die there. Moshe said die. And he's the one that had to move them on. Vayasa Moshe Sam. And therefore, in Rashi's analysis, the gold, if that's what caused them to make the Egel, it wasn't gold that they said die to. And therefore, the fact remains that the gold was the catalyst for the Egel, but Rashi, to use the phrase advisedly, formats the statement of the Gemara in order to apply it to explain the Pasuk in keeping with the other sources that he has brought. And that's very interesting. Not only for itself, because it opens up an entire new area of investigation within Rashi's Perush. Most of Rashi is not Rashi. Most of Rashi is sourced in Chazal, Gemara, Midrashim. And the question then becomes, looking at the source of Rashi and looking at the words of Rashi, in what way does Rashi, whose goal is different than that of the Medrash, because the Medrash is to explain to you what the Medrash wants to explain to you. Rashi's job is to explain to you Pshuto Shel Mikra. Sometimes those goals part ways, and therefore Rashi will use the words of the Medrash, but not always in exactly the way that the Medrash did. And that becomes an entire new area of discussion within Rashi. So that's Vidi Zahav. And let's move from the general words of Tochacha to a specific area of Tochacha. Interestingly, the Egel and the Meraglim, the order is reversed in terms of the Tochacha of Moshe. Within 23 Psukim, he's already talking about the Meraglim. He doesn't talk about the Egel until Parshas Ekev. That's very interesting in itself as to why Moshe reversed the order of those two enormous episodes. But if we take a look at Perek Aleph, Pasuk Kaf Beis, as Moshe begins to discuss the Meraglim. And here we find out, of course we know it already from last year, but it's not mentioned in Parshas Shelach, that originally the idea to send Meraglim was that of the Jewish people. It was not, so to speak, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's idea. And here it comes out, V'tikruvu ne'lai kulchem, you came to me, V'tomu nishlecha nashim lefaneinu, that send people, V'yachbu lanu esa'aretz, and they'll spy out the land, V'yashivu son of Davar, and let them give us information, Esaderech asher na'alabe, which way should we go, V'esarim asher navo alein, which city should we approach first. Now, Rashi has a very interesting comment to make on the words Vatikrivun Elai Kulchem. You all approached me. What is there to say? Well, Rashi says, on the word Kulchem, Be'erbuvya, you were all mixed up. Me'uravim, Be'erbuvya, meaning Yeladim dofum asazakenim, the younger were pushing aside the older. Zakenim dofum asaroshim, and the older were pushing aside the heads of the people. Everyone was pushing. It's not nice. Kulchem. Presumably, Rashi sees the word kulchem as redundant, because vatikruvune lie, if it doesn't mean all of them, then it doesn't have to mean all of them. So if the pasuk says kulchem, all of you, it means it has the connotation of all of you at once. Berbuvia, there's no Seder. And Moshe Rabbeinu is communicating to the Jewish people that that wasn't right. That's not a correct way to approach anyone. Pushing, trying to get the other person out of your way, it's not correct behavior. It's fascinating to consider that set against the enormous debacle of the Meraglim, Moshe doesn't let the Jewish people off from Derech Eretz. In other words, what's to come is a tragedy which continues until our times. But Moshe says, and we'll get to all of that, but be aware as well. Why should you push the person in front of you? If they're older than you, have some patience. It's a very interesting blend of tochacha, almost from the greatest of the great to the smallest of the small. Nothing escapes the rebuke. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky discusses this matter. And of course, this brings us back to a question that we will always ask about Parsha Shelach. Is it wrong to send Meraglim? Is that a categorically incorrect path? It was the idea ill-conceived from the start. It's interesting that Moshe himself says in the very next pasuk, "Vayita ve'ena hadavar." I thought it was a good idea. So apparently, it was a good idea. So is there no room for criticism of the idea itself? Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, there are two concepts that often are discussed together, but it's important to realize exactly how they go together. They are the concepts of bitachon and hishtadlus. Bitachon, trust in Hashem, hishtadlus, putting in your effort. And as we know, there's got to be room for both. Meaning a person has to have bitachon, but a person also has to do hishtadlus. And it sounds like sending Meraglim is not such an outrageous idea, especially in the way that they presented it. Which way should we enter? It doesn't sound unreasonable at all. But what's critical to realize about the relationship between bitachon and hishtadlus, and sometimes looked at from a superficial perspective, a mistake is made. Namely, these two things must go together. And the reason why we stress that is because there is sometimes a notion that the two actually are mutually exclusive. As if to say, everyone knows that on the one hand, one needs to trust in Hashem, on the other hand, one needs to do their part. But sometimes the feeling is, never the twain shall meet. As if to say, I'll do my part, Hashem will do his part, and between the two of us we'll work it out. But if that's true, then the negative concept that emerges is that when I'm doing my part, God isn't doing anything. When I finish, that's when he starts. So if my hishtadlus is 9 to 5, if we remember such a concept, so that means that for those 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 hours, that's my part. And then when I leave the office, then God comes in and he takes care of the rest. That's a mistake because it doesn't allow room for any activity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself within what I'm doing. I do my things and he does his things. But that's not what bitachon is. Bitachon is, I need to act responsibly. My trust is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bless my efforts. So on the contrary, 10 hours of hishtadlus without a sense of bitachon is 10 hours of a godless existence. But rather, the two go together. That's the point. They're fused. Everything that I do, it's with a sense of, these are my efforts. I trust that God will bless them. He's here with me. He doesn't just enter the office when I leave. And if that's true, then probably the most important thing to realize about bitachon is that it's actually a state of mind. That is to say, it's not merely a belief, quote unquote, but rather the difference between a person who goes about their activities with the feeling that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is looking after those activities for them. They have a sense of grace that someone wouldn't have if they feel that for these 10 hours, im eina nidi mili, it's me or no one, because Hashem isn't involved in these hours. And therefore, it's probably correct to say with regards to bitachon, if it was ever true for anything, it's not necessarily what you do, it's the way that you do it. Because if you approach your parnasa and all of your engagements with a sense of bitachon, it's a different tone, it's a different atmosphere entirely. And this brings us back to the Meraglim. And we ask the question, was it good for the Jews? Was it bad for the Jews? Was it a good idea? It's hishtadlus. Well, so now the question is, well, is hishtadlus a good idea? Should people try and take care of things by themselves? The answer is, if the hishtadlus itself is done from a standpoint, right, from a launch of bitachon, so that's what it's all about. That's entirely positive. But if it's done as an act of a lack of bitachon, the Jewish people cannot afford to go into the land of Israel by themselves without God helping them. So how can you tell? The answer, says Rabbi Yaakov, is if you wish to get a sense of the atmosphere when this idea was hatched, so consider how it was presented to Moshe. If the Jewish people approach Moshe, tripping over each other, and trampling over each other, and pushing each other out of the way, I mean, what does that say about the mood? What does that say about their feeling in terms of communicating this idea to Moshe? Aside from the question as to, you know, how many Jews does it take to communicate an idea to Moshe? I mean, apparently the answer is all of them. But it's the same idea. One of them will do, or the Nisiim will do. They don't all need to come to Moshe, and they certainly don't need to all come at once. And therefore, says Rabbi Yaakov, when Moshe is rebuking them, it's a very sobering moment when Moshe is rebuking them that you pushed each other, that's how you approached. It's not, quote unquote, just an issue of Derech Eretz. It's a statement about the inception of the entire idea of sending the Meraglim, because it represents an atmosphere of panic, of desperation, as if to say, if you don't, all of you at the same time, tell Moshe to send Meraglim right now, it won't happen. As if to intimate that Moshe himself won't think of it, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu won't think of it, even if it's a good idea. That's not a correct approach at all. That's hishtadlus, which is bereft of a sense of bitachon. And that type of hishtadlus, says Moshe Rabbeinu, Vayita Ve'ene HaDavar, I thought it was a good idea. That's part of the tragedy. It was a good idea, but it was approached in the wrong way. It was a good idea that turned sour. And that's an important lesson for Bnei Yisrael to learn for all generations. It's interesting to note, and we've mentioned in the past, that as surely as someone who has bitachon, so there is a certain sense of literally trust and grace that they have as they approach the things that they do, it will also define, in a sense, the circle of their ishtadlus, because as surely as there's no room for a mood of desperation, there's also no room for a desperate act. A desperate act is a symptom of lack of bitachon, each one on their own level. And what's important about bitachon is it's not like a lulav and esrog where one size fits all. It's very, very case specific, each person in terms of where they are and what they're doing. But this is the principle that emerges from one of the earliest lessons we have in bitachon, which is from Yosef. And Yosef paid a heavy price with regards to the maneuvering between bitachon and ishtadlus. As we know, the pasuk says on the one hand, Ashrei hagever, asher sam Hashem bitachon, happy is the person who trusts in Hashem. Ze Yosef, says the Medrash. That's the first thing. In other words, Yosef, in principle, he is a person who is very much in line with bitachon. But the pasuk goes on to say, Velo pona el rehovim, and didn't turn to the haughty, says the Medrash, but that's also Yosef, at least in one instance. Because he said to the Sara Mashkim, Kim Zechartani, Viskartani, Aparo, remember me, and he was punished for that. Because the Sara Mashkim forgot about him. And he spent another 2 years in the Beis HaSoar. So now the question, of course, that everyone asks is, what should Yosef have done? In other words, where is the problem here? Is the moral of the story not to say anything? Is that as if to say nothing? There's no room for any hishtadlus? After all, we're talking about one sentence per 10 years, which is rather mild on the hishtadlus scale. He sees an opportunity and takes it. And that was wrong. That means that on Yosef's level, there should have been no hishtadlus? Says the Chazon Ish, no, not at all. There's always room for hishtadlus. But if a person does something which is desperate, which could never really work, then that already shows, again, each one on their level, a certain lacking in Ishtadlus. That is why the Pasuk specifically characterizes the Saramashkim as Rehovim, Rahav. Rahav is someone who is haughty, who is proud, who is arrogant. That is the type of person whose very nature dictates that they will not remember the one who is responsible for their success, especially if the alternative is to leave them languishing in jail where no one will ever hear of them, because it's either him being in a pit out of circulation and I don't owe him anything, or him being in circulation, which is a constant reminder of the fact that he's the reason why I got out of jail. No one who is possessed of the character trait of Rahav will ever give credit to their sources for anything. Not in their interpretation of dreams, not in their footnotes, and not in their experimental data, or anything else in between. It's all homegrown. In fact, I was just wondering this evening, it's neither here nor there, but it's interesting to consider, once Yosef got out, whether or not the Saramashkim made a point of avoiding him, because there must have been an uncomfortable situation when they met, and they're both really frequenting Paro's court, and the topic would come up as, why did it take you 2 years? When it was you, everything you have, you owe to me. And were it not for the circumstance of Paro's dream, it would have been more than 2 years. Says the Chazon Ish, to turn to a Rahav, to turn to someone whose very nature dictates that he will forget you, that's a criticism of for Yosef on his level. And we see it, by the way. Because, amazingly, and this is pointed out by Rav Chaim Friedlander in the Sefer Sifsei Chaim, Yosef, as soon as he gets out of jail, engages in Hishtadlus, within moments. We see this when he's called to interpret Paro's dream, and which he does so successfully, and then the very next thing he does is to start to feed Paro advice, which does pretty much everything except name himself. Paro, you're probably wondering what to do now. Well, let me tell you that you should appoint someone who's talented, smart, capable. I think you know what I'm talking about. And then Paro, you know, says, well, that's you. And Yosef says, well, yes, I suppose it is. So, but what's fact? And we see this the whole time in Parshas Miketz. And if we see it in abstract, we say, well, okay, that seems perfectly reasonable. But remember, says the Sifsei Chaim, Yosef was burnt 2 years ago for doing what seems exactly like this, for engaging in Hishtadlus, where perhaps at this point, relying on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How can he have recovered his composure to such a degree to engage headlong right now with Paro in the very thing that he came to grief over? The answer is, it depends who you're talking to. Hishtadlus per se is not treif. Kosher Hishtadlus is when Paro's there in front of his court, you see he needs help, and you know that you're the person to put your name forward. That's entirely appropriate, and Yosef does not hesitate, and his efforts are rewarded. That's kosher Hishtadlus. To be able to draw that line and not to have shied away from any form of Hishtadlus based on recent experiences, that also takes a certain fortitude of spirit. And therefore, to come back to the Meraglim, it's such a profound point within the idea of Bitachon, which often is so murky and vague, and especially how it relates to the idea of Hishtadlus, to understand that ultimately the two go together, they empower each other, because kosher Hishtadlus, by definition, is that which is accompanied by Bitachon. I'd like to devote some words to Bein HaMetzorim. It's not nice to talk about, but on the other hand, every year I harbor the feeling that it may no longer be current if I wait till next year, and therefore next year will be Torah Lishma. So when it comes to the Bein HaMetzorim, days that are difficult to navigate, really, or they should be, with regards to the concept of Avelus, again, not pleasant to talk about, but we're in a time of Avelus. I mean, the Halacha recognizes two types of Avelus. There's individual Avelus, lo aleinu, Avelus for a bereavement, for a relative. And there is national Avelus, Avelus for the Churban of Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael, the Beis HaMikdash. And what's interesting is that as much as they have so much in common, of course, but in one respect, they part ways. Namely, the progression of whether the avelus is mild or more intense. In that respect, the gradation and the direction changes. Lo aleinu, when it comes to a avelus of an individual, of course, it begins with the event. And that's the most intense time. And then gradually, it gets milder. It becomes the shiva, which becomes the shloshim, and for a parent, it becomes the year. And in a sense, it's one moves down from the time of avelus. With regards to the Churban, it's the opposite. In other words, Tisha B'Av is the end, meaning it's the end of the avelus, almost. It begins 3 weeks earlier with a certain aspects of avelus and then gets progressively more. And it's very interesting that the flow of energy really is reversed with regards to that type of avelus. And why is that so? And this is a matter which is discussed by Rabbi Shlomo Fischer, Shlita, and the Sefer Beis Yishai. And he says, and it's quite a chiddush, but when we hear it, it has the ring of the meaning for us. There is an essential difference between the two types of avelus, a fundamental difference. If we look at the sources, we will see, it's a little bit startling to hear this, but when it comes to the avelus for an individual, a family bereavement, the goal of avelus is not to suffer. It's not pain. It's not anguish. That is there, to the extent that it's there, it's there. But avelus is not to promote it. What avelus is promoting is respect for the departed. That is it. The way that the departed is respected is he doesn't leave the world unnoticed, because that's the ultimate bizayon. It is marked. People get together. They talk about it. The world is not the same place. That is the ultimate show of respect. His presence made a difference, and his absence makes a difference. That's what it's all about. And we can see it in the halacha. Under certain circumstances, I mean, this is actually discussed explicitly in the Gemara. One just needs to make sure we don't gloss over it. Under certain circumstances, the concept of osek b'mitzvah potam min ha-mitzvah, when you're involved in one mitzvah, you're exempt from another mitzvah, with regards to some items, we're not going to get into details, but even if one is preoccupied with a mitzvah, tirda of a mitzvah, tarud, can also exempt you from certain other mitzvahs. And once the Gemara mentions that, so it asks the question, but do we not know that an avel, lo aleinu, a mourner, he's obligated in more or less all mitzvahs. But is he not tarud? Is he not preoccupied? Is he not upset? Says the Gemara, that is tirda of reshus. That upset is not a mitzvah. We're talking about a person who is preoccupied with a mitzvah. The preoccupation of an avel is not a mitzvah. What a thing to say. How can that be? Says the Shlomo Fischer, because the preoccupation of an avel, that's a natural, his distress and his anguish, those are natural feelings. The mitzvah is not about them. They are what they are. If they're there, and they should be there, you don't need a mitzvah to express them. And if they're not there, a mitzvah is not going to help. A person's relationships with their family members are what they are. The mitzvah is not coming to affect that. It is entirely an issue of showing kavod to the mace. And it is for this reason, says the Fisher, further demonstrating this point, that the halacha is, let's say a person passes away and they have no family members. So is there any shiva? There is, says the Gemara, Masechet Shabbos, Daf Kuf Nun Beis. 10 people need to get together and sit shiva for them. These are people who don't necessarily even know them. Where is the anguish? But that type of avelus is not about it. It's about respect. A Jew has passed from the world. People need to know it. People need to something has happened. That's the mark of respect. With regards to the avelus of the Beis HaMikdash, the opposite is true. It's not about respect. Respect for the Beis HaMikdash is very important. But in a time of Gaulah, there's something more important. We need to be in anguish over the lacking of the Beis HaMikdash. And that being the case, the halachas of avelus are coming to promote those feelings of tzar. We need to be upset that there is no Beis HaMikdash. And we should know further, it's a detail, but it's a striking point. An Ovel, as we know, does not learn Torah. And on Tisha B'Av as well, we don't learn Torah. It's interesting to note that there are two separate sources for those halachos. The source for not learning Torah for an Ovel is not the same source for not learning Torah on Tisha B'Av. When it comes to an Ovel, the source, as this says the Gemara in Moed Katan in the third Perek, is a pasuk in Yechezkel. Heanek dom. You need to be silent. And the Gemara understands that means silent from words of Torah. When it comes to to Tisha B'Av, the Gemara says in Maseches Ta'anis, you can't learn Torah. Torah says, Pikudi Hashem Yishori Mesam Chilev, learning Torah, gladdens the heart. That's not appropriate for Tisha B'Av. It's very interesting that the very same halacha derived from two different tributaries, from two different sources. Says of Shlomo Fisher, it's for the reason that we've established. Because the issue of Mesam Chelev, if Torah gladdens the heart, so if a person is an Ovel over a family member, so for something to gladden his heart, that's not the problem. The problem is if he starts talking in words of Torah, Heanek Dom, so then it sounds like he's not interested in his family members who's recently departed. He's busy with other things, he's busy with Divrei Torah, business as usual. So it's about the silence, because the silence from Torah is respect for the departed. But when it comes to Tisha B'Av, it's not about silence. It's about Mesam Chelev. You can't afford to be happy on Tisha B'Av because you shouldn't be happy. Something's missing. And it's for that reason, says of Shlomo Fisher, that the gradation and of the Avelus goes in two different directions. Because when it comes to a private Avelus, so the event is what it is, and then the person shows respect, then gradually moves away. However he feels, that's how he feels. Avelus is not going to make a difference. Halachos will not make a difference. But when it comes to the Beis HaMikdash, on the contrary, it is the feeling of Avelus that needs to be promoted, and therefore one needs, in a sense, to get ready for Tisha B'Av, if it will be that year. It can't start on Tisha B'Av. If the Avelus begins on Tisha B'Av, it doesn't begin. And therefore it starts 3 weeks earlier. Life is not the same. There are certain restrictions. It's not business as usual. And then it gets greater. And then there's the 9 days. And then Shavuot Shechalbo. And then Erev Tisha B'Av. And all of these things, they make a person ready for Tisha B'Av, because it's a consciousness of what Tisha B'Av is all about. That's what's being promoted by these halachas. We should know that indeed the 3 weeks, the 9 days, they're dark times for the Jewish people. The times of din. In fact, as the B'nai Soschar points out, in the 9 days, 24 hours each day, has a total of 216 hours, which is the gematria of the word gevura. And gevura, of course, is a watchword for din. The times of gevura, the times of din. And moreover, the pasuk says in Eicha, in Perek Gimel, Dov Orevuli, Hashem, so to speak, he's a bear, lies in waiting. Ariba Mistarim. Ariya, the lion, concealed, ready to pounce. Ariye, Aleph Resh Yud He, has a similar gematria of 216. Those are the difficult times of the 9 days. And in the thick of it all, and it's a paradox, really, because the Yerushalmi says that the most auspicious time for Mashiach to be born is on the afternoon of Tisha B'Av, Mincha time of Tisha B'Av. And it's reflected in the halacha, because certain of the halachas of Tisha B'Av are alleviated. We no longer sit on the floor. And what that means is that if Tisha B'Av has been used the way that it should, then already within Tisha B'Av itself there's room for hope, and the din is lessened. Mincha time begins 6.5 hours. That gives you five complete hours. The last 5 hours of Tisha B'Av are hours, in a sense, of cautious mourning of optimism. And we find that pasuk, which says Hashem is Ariyeh B'Mistarim, he's the lion concealed. There is a kriyuksiv, as we know. The word is written Ariyeh. It's read as Ari. What that means is the final hay, which represents the final 5 hours of Tisha B'Av, are read but not said. They're part of the word, but not part of the word. They're present, but it's a different atmosphere already, because those 5 hours are the hours that the Mashiach can be born. So what's written as Ariyeh is read as Ari. And moreover, the Gemara says in Maseches Bava Basra, in the first Perek, that we know generally the learning of Torah has the property to bring the Geula closer. The learning of Mishnah, Eina Golios Miskabzos Ele Bischus HaMishnah. And in fact, the famous Sefer Megale Amukos, Reb Nosson Shapira, notes that in the 3 weeks, we spoke about the 216 hours of the 9 days, in the 22 days of the 3 weeks, there are 528 hours. And says the Megale Amukos, there are 528 chapters of Mishnayos, because each chapter corresponds to and is dealing with one of these aspects of Avelus. And you know, sometimes there are Mefarshim, they see a statement like that, 528 chapters of Mishnayos, and they count. Rabbi Yeshaya Berlin, the famous Acharonim, he counted, and he had a kasha in the Megale Amukos, because there's actually only 523, not 528. What do we say? Says the Bnei Yisoschar, it's true. There's only 523 chapters of Mishnayos. But if you look at any edition of Mishnayos, there are 528 chapters. Because there are five times throughout the Shas where there is a chapter there, which is not a Mishnah, but it's from the Tosefta. Which is not exactly a Mishnah, but it's still from Chazal. Didn't make it into the Mishnah. Doesn't have that voltage of a Mishnah, but it's still a chapter of learning, and it's in the Mishnayos. Says the Bnei Yisoschar, there are 528 hours in those 22 days. The reason why there's only 523 chapters of Mishnayos is because until you get to the final 5 hours of Tisha B'Av, you need Mishnah in order to deal with the situation. But the alleviation and the optimism that is represented by the climate that allows for the birth of the Mashiach means that for the final 5 hours, Tosefta will do. You don't need that currency of a Mishnah because you aren't dealing with the same stripe of Avelus. So these are important things for us to consider, that the 3 weeks and the 9 days, they're difficult times, but the tragedy is compounded if they pass us by without us realizing what they're about, without us coming to miss the Beis HaMikdash. And it's not hard to miss the Beis HaMikdash because the Chotiv Kebalayla, everything that we see around us, all of the difficulties that exist for the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael, outside of Eretz Yisrael, the vilification of the Jewish people, the double standards and the lack of justice and all of that, is these are emanations of the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. When the Mikdash is al Machono, that's not the way things are meant to look. So we have, unfortunately, living evidence all those hundreds and thousands of years later of the Churban, and if we begin there and work our way backwards, we should certainly have what to ponder over in Emirat Hashem. It should bring us closer to these days, being turned from days of Avelus to days of Soson v'Simcha b'Meher v'Yamin.